Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
The effects of climate change are being witnessed all over the world. It's the biggest story right now.
There are downright apocalyptic images coming out of Australia right now as the country's battling hundreds of fires that have burned across the country for months now.
Roads and villages turned into rivers overnight and tens of thousands displaced. Many areas in central and southern Somalia have been completely cut off, and people here are now in urgent need of aid.
Greenland's ice sheet is the biggest in the northern hemisphere, and it's in meltdown. All of this is a warning sign for the world.
We hear it all the time. This is a dire situation. Time is running out. It's a crisis. And it makes you wonder, if we knew what we know now decades ago, could we have done something to stop the devastation? Could much of what we're seeing today been reversed? And the troubling answer is probably yes. In fact, some people did know what was happening as far back as the 1960s. Major fossil fuel companies are alleged to have known about the science, and worse, that they were contributing. One major Canadian company in particular did its own research and ignored the findings. And as we hear from our guest today, Imperial Oil could have changed its business model, could have been a leader to fight climate change, but instead, it just decided to make a bigger profit off it. I'm Richard Southern, in for Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Murtaza Hussein is a writer at The Intercept. He joins us now. Hi, Murtaza. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Interesting article, one that I think is going to, you know, be a real eye-opener for a lot of people, maybe anger a lot of people. First off, it's really centering around a company that we use here in Canada a lot, whether we know it or not. Tell us, what is Imperial Oil? Who are they?
So Imperial Oil is the Canadian subsidiary of ExxonMobil, the famous fossil fuel company. It's best known in Canada, though, at the consumer level for its Esso brand gas stations. So Imperial is essentially Exxon's arm in Canada, and Esso is its most prominent consumer manifestation.
Yeah, they're everywhere. You know, put a tagger in your tank, right? And you're saying, going back to what, the 1960s, Imperial Oil knew about the dangers of climate change. What exactly did they know back then, Murtaza?
Well, in the 1960s, the specific contours of the problem were coming into view. They were not definite about climate change per se at that time, but they knew that they were causing serious harm to the environment, and they knew that this would eventually lead to a public outcry if Canadians became aware of the full scope of the harm that they were causing. And, you know, at this time, you think of things like air quality, destruction of habitat, destruction of ecosystems. It was only in the later decades, by the 90s, they were very, very sure about the science of climate change. So we're talking maybe almost three decades ago. They had come to a high degree of certainty about the impacts of climate change. Despite that knowledge, they did not change their behavior and, in fact, did whatever they could to prevent the public from reaching the same level of certainty about this issue that they had.
Well, what did they do to sway public opinion away from what they knew was a fact, that climate change was real and that they were participating in it? What did they do to sway public opinion?
Well, over the decades, Imperial has been very concerned about the possibility of public backlash, and particularly if that backlash led to calls for regulation of their activities or the imposition of climate or environmental regulation that somehow impacted their ability to carry out their operations. So going back to the 60s and then onwards from there, they attempted to do their own public relations campaigns to sway public opinion to muddy the waters over their own environmental record and to push back against any organized attempt to curtail their activities. But it wasn't just PR. It was also surveillance of non-governmental organizations in Canada, local ones like the Canadian Arctic Commission and other consumer advocacy groups to, you know, go on the offensive against these people, even though they were much smaller than Imperial Oil, of course, much smaller than ExxonMobil.
What do you mean surveillance? Were they like following people around?
Well, the documents show that they were compiling dossiers on environmental groups in Canada, information about their key spokespeople, their finances, their addresses. So these documents give us some insight into the type of activities they could carry out if they had chosen to, or if they did, they certainly, it was on the table for them.
Did they do anything, Imperial Oil, to try and mitigate climate change? I mean, you write in your article that a PR company analyzed different ways that the company could reduce its carbon footprint. Did they do anything?
Well, in the early 90s, you know, many, many decades ago now, they essentially knew that for society to avoid the catastrophic impacts of climate change, it would need to move from fossil fuel extraction to renewables, techniques like carbon capture. Many of the things that we still discuss today as being necessary to avert the climate crisis. But the thing is, despite this knowledge, they did not, to any significant degree, change their operation. They continued to extract at the same levels and even higher levels year over year to this day. They did not engage in the fundamental structural changes that they needed to avert this crisis. But one thing that they did do, and I think this is quite telling, is that they changed the design of their own platforms in the Arctic and elsewhere to accommodate the fact of rising sea levels and melting sea ice. So they knew this was real so strongly that they changed their own platform designs to accommodate that, but they did not embark on the structural changes to their business model that would have been necessary. And it's even more unfortunate because if they had done that, they would have had a first mover advantage in renewable energy.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about the Arctic, and you mentioned in your article, and this is maybe one of the more shocking things, is that they looked, Imperial Oil looked at the melting sea ice as a new business opportunity for them, right?
Right. So essentially, you know, Imperial and other fossil fuel companies, they, for a very long time, had the best climate research capacities of any organization in the world. They knew very intimately the impact of climate change around the world, on the atmosphere, and in the Arctic. And now they developed these capacities partly for the reasons I mentioned earlier, because they were concerned about public backlash over their environmental record. They wanted to get as good a picture as possible. But what they also did was that they used this research capacity, which had ostensibly developed to, you know, hopefully reduce environmental harm or get a better picture of it, also to scope out new business opportunities that may emerge in a radically degraded environment.
They said, hey, the fact that there's less sea ice is going to allow us to go up further into the Arctic and drill for more oil, right?
More or less. Maybe more technical language, but the gist of it was that the fate of Arctic sea ice will determine how Imperial operates in the Arctic.
Right. Another interesting thing, too, with Imperial Oil was how they saw carbon taxing coming many years ago and how they were sure that that would actually mitigate some of the climate change effects, right? What did they say about carbon pricing all those years ago?
Well, they knew that carbon pricing would be necessary to reduce fossil fuel emissions, but they essentially lowballed the numbers. They knew that much higher numbers would have been needed even many decades ago, that they made proposals which were at odds with their own private knowledge. And essentially, you know, if we were to have carbon taxes today, which we do need, they would need to be much, much higher than they would have needed to be several decades ago when Imperial and other companies had essentially deceived the public.
What was Imperial Oil's response to all this? You asked them for a response to these documents you got about all the knowledge they had. What did they say?
Well, you know, one thing that I, that's in the article is very important is that they knew these things privately, but for many years thereafter, CEOs of Imperial were saying things in public which were completely at odds with their own private research and completely at odds with the consensus of climate change. Namely, in the late 90s, you know, Imperial CEO Robert Peterson was saying that carbon dioxide is good for the environment, it's not a pollutant, there's no consensus about this issue at all, and, you know, essentially it's open to debate. Internally, they knew it was not open to debate, and this was very serious and very real. So, you know, their response in the light of this was just that they take this issue seriously and they're committed to doing what they can to avert the climate crisis. And, you know, the thing is, we're not going to avert this crisis if it's business as usual. Something is going to have to change. It should have changed 3 decades ago, 4 decades ago. But if it does not radically change now, we're going to have to prepare for a very ugly future in the past, which the vast majority of people, including many Canadians, are going to suffer grievously.
Should we be shocked by this? I mean, you know, the cigarette companies knew their product caused cancer. I guess the candy companies probably knew sugar wasn't very good for people, but they kept selling it. This is what capitalism demands. Should we be singling energy companies like Imperial Oil out? Aren't they just doing what capitalism demands of them?
Well, the difference between the tobacco industry and big sugar and fossil fuel industry is that the consequences of these lies are much, much greater than other basic consumer products. And that's to say, not to say that the impact of tobacco and sugar on the health of Canadians and others has not been grievous, but we're talking about potentially an existential threat to industrial civilization, post-industrial civilization. We may not have a planet anymore on which to even make future mistakes or to rectify our current mistakes. That's why it's really, really far more serious than those other phenomena, although those were also serious. Now we're talking about something that we've never experienced before. Human beings have never done anything on such a scale as what they've now begun to do to the climate.
Do you think that the PR campaign, the muddying of the waters, as you put it, that Imperial Oil engaged in, do you think that worked? I mean, you know, we've got plenty of climate change deniers. We've had big elections in the UK and the US in recent years, and climate change has hardly come up. Did what Imperial Oil do over the past decades, do you think it's worked?
Yeah, well, I think what you just said is correct. We're still far from a consensus about this issue, even though the impacts of climate change are physically starting to manifest, which means things are getting already very bad and very late. We see the fires in Australia as the latest example of that. I think the most successful result of this PR campaign is just to delay action pretty much indefinitely. I think there are a lot of younger people, especially, who are recognizing this as an issue, but it's just so late now. It's become so late, and so many years have been lost that could have been used to address this, that I guess it's a successful campaign.
And I mean, we still got to go to work. We still got to go to Esso to fill up the car to get to work, right? So it's a tough issue. Where does Imperial Oil stand with this right now when it comes to climate change?
Well, you know, Imperial and other fossil fuel companies, they tend to change their rhetoric based on the level of public pressure. They never want to look radically out of odds with the public consensus. And now that you're starting to see some more popular movements and more attention being given to climate change, certainly their rhetoric is not like what it was in the late 90s when they were saying that carbon dioxide is actually good for the environment. So, you know, in that sense, it's been a rhetorical change. But, you know, the raw fact is that year over year, last year, they increased their barrel per day output over the previous year. They're increasing their output. So anything else is really immaterial. Nothing is changing.
But why wouldn't they? I mean, that's what they have to do to make money. It seems like if they're the first to change, they would be at a disadvantage. You mentioned earlier you felt they would actually have a first mover advantage if they were among the first energy companies to move towards renewables, right?
Yeah, that's why it can't really be left to them or any other company to change. They have to be regulated by the government. And then the regulation will impact, you know, all parties. And it's not a choice then. It'll be something that's mandated by the law for the public good of Canadians and the planet, really. I'm not surprised that they haven't changed because, as you said, they're doing exactly what the system suggests they should do, and they should try to continue to make as much money as they can for as long as they can But we can't have a planet that way. That's the only problem. We have to act democratically to curtail these activities as soon as we can.
You mentioned government regulation. Did you see anything in these documents going back over the decades that you analyzed about how they perhaps lobbied the government or dealt with the Canadian government?
No, there's nothing in these documents particularly about that, about lobbying per se. Although there are other documents archived which have yet to be analyzed. But there is a lot about their own responses strategically to government discussions of regulation. They were positioning their own arguments and strategies to try to diffuse or shape the contours of any future government regulation that may be coming down the line. They were trying to just be flexible in such a way rhetorically that such that their business does not have to change.
With all these documents you went over, what stuck out to you the most? What shocked you the most?
Well, the fact that fossil fuel companies, Exxon in particular, and subsidiaries effectively lied about climate change a long time ago is something that's been known. So I can't say that I was shocked per se, but I was disheartened by the additional information and the granular detail about just how this took place and how deep the deception went. And, you know, of course, as a Canadian, it's kind of sad to see that a Canadian company engaged in such predatory behavior. And predatory is putting it lightly. We don't really have language even to describe how bad this is. And, you know, Esso, we're all familiar with Esso and have seen these extremely negative and destructive reality of a very familiar consumer name, it's quite sobering.
It was surprising to me, you pointed out, that throughout the 70s and 80s, Exxon and by extension Imperial were the leading researchers on climate change. Were you surprised to find that out? You'd think there'd be other independent groups looking at it, but it was actually the oil companies that were the biggest climate change researchers.
Well, they had the most money. They had the most incentive to understand what exactly they were doing. They were the ones doing it. And you know, they were best positioned to do it. So, but the only they did it because they were afraid about, you know, the potential for a backlash if people understood how bad this was. So that really was a spur to motivate them to expand these capacities. You know, now there are other ways of, you know, there is government support and private support for climate research. But yeah, they got the ball rolling on that, except that they did not use that research for good, you could say. They just kept it private while doing something else in public.
But was there a business model for them to change to? If in the 60s they had said, okay, we're going to start, building wind turbines here instead of drilling for oil, would that have been a viable business model for them?
Well, you know, the 60s were pretty early in the game, and renewables were not as expansive as they are today. But certainly by the 80s and the 90s, they absolutely could. They had the money to do it. They had a lot of flexibility, and they're totally aware, actually, of what needed to be done. They just didn't do it because the path of greatest short-term profit is to continue doing what you're doing as much as you can, even if it's the sacrifice of long-term profit and the sacrifice of the society in the long term.
Now you say there's been some court cases brought against some of the oil companies in light of this news. What's going on with that? What's the latest on that?
Well, essentially, there are court cases against Exxon to impose some sort of consequences for their evident years of deception on the climate crisis. Those cases are working their way through the courts right now in the United States. It remains to be seen what the outcome will be, but you know, this is the first step trying to get at least some financial restitution for this terrible crisis.
I mean, where do we go from here? I mean, it seems like this information, which you know, was pretty shocking when we read your article, hasn't really had a huge impact. I mean, it seems like people just kind of look past it, don't they?
Well, you know, people who are interested in climate change add to the public record about that. But you know, this is not new information. This is some information which has been out there. This is just more detail about something which has now become undeniable. And the thing that's really going to wake people up is when their own habitats become unlivable, like the people in Australia at the moment. But at that point, it'll be too late.
Well, very eye-opening article. And Murtaza, thank you so much for giving us a couple of minutes here to talk about it. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Murtaza Hussein is a writer at The Intercept. That was The Big Story. For more episodes, go to thebigstorypodcast.ca or visit us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. And of course, The Big Story is wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Southern. Thanks for listening.